This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's no doubt that the coronavirus pandemic has made its mark on Northwest Indiana. We've seen schools close. We've seen fewer workers on the trains and the buses to go to work, if they have jobs, unfortunately. Traffic congestion on the highways has declined, and there have been lots of changes in how we hold meetings when it comes to work and sometimes personal calls. And that's also being reflected in commerce here in Northwest Indiana, in particular in e-commerce. Well, the Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission has taken time to study the COVID-19 impact on e-commerce. In fact, they've created a report about it, and let's find out more about that report. Ty Warner is Executive Director of NERPC, and he's joining us today to talk about it. Ty, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking.
Chris, great to be with you. Glad to be here. And thanks for talking about this topic. This is important for the future of our region.
Well, it's very important. And I know from the report, even though I just took a look at some of the basic details, the full report's on the website for NERPC, by the way, if anybody wants to check it out. But it talks about the major changes, the shifts in commerce that we have seen, some rather dynamic shifts. Why don't you just break it out for us? Tell us where we've seen the big changes as a result of the pandemic and what impact it's had on all businesses in the region.
Absolutely. You know, it's always interesting when data backs up what your anecdotal experience is, and that's certainly the case now. And the timing with this report, we started this before the pandemic. E-commerce was already a big part of the shift in the economy, which I think we all knew. But now with the pandemic upon us and you know, the drastic decreases in travel and the way people are conducting business and their willingness to go out and all of the rest, even more timely and more important for the future of the region. So let me just start, first of all, by saying this all originated by our NWI 2050 document, which is our regional vision plan for the future of Northwest Indiana. Mm-hmm. And that is, we adopted that in 2019 and already identified the importance of e-commerce and how much the landscape was changing in the drastic increase in the amount of retail. Changes in retail trips, and that bore out by a household travel survey that we conducted, which many of your listeners may have received. This was randomly sent across Lakeport and LaPorte counties, and people responded to where they were going, all voluntary, of course. But that was pulled together in the aggregate and then analyzed. And boy, one of the things that jumped out at us right away was the difference in retail trips. Back in 2008, when we had last done this household travel survey, over 21% of retail trips were for shopping trips, retail, mm-hmm. going to stores and whatnot. And then the results of the survey, which was largely in 2018, that had dropped to 9%. So 12% decrease just in 10 years of retail trips. And that just bears out, I think, everybody's experience, much more online, much more purchasing of things getting delivered right to your door, coupled with the increase that we're seeing on the roadway that I think everyone sees when they're out and about, is the increase in, you know, Amazon Prime trucks, FedEx, UPS, even to the point where they're having to rent, you know, you see the budget and U-Haul, you know, rent a truck, so to speak, coming to deliver your packages because it's that difficult to keep up with demand. Well, that's during the pandemic. Even before that, between 2014 and 2018, truck traffic has already been drastically increasing, whereas overall, we measure, this gets a little technical, but we measure vehicle miles traveled for the region. And that has stayed somewhat flat between 2014 and 2018, a very, very minor increase. But truck traffic has definitely increased. And I think that's all a result of the way that we do shopping and the way that we do commerce.
Now, what do you all find at NERPC in putting together the report of the impact? Not only, as you mentioned, we have fewer trips made to the store over time. We have more vehicles on the road. These are delivery trucks, the ones that are marked and the ones that aren't marked, because a lot of these prime trucks are not marked as such, but they're still out there.
Right.
And what are you finding as far as the storefronts of the big box stores and brick and mortar stores? What's the impact all been on them right now?
Right. Well, I think a lot of your listeners have already experienced, you know, beloved restaurants, shopping opportunities, things that they had long thought would just be around forever, suddenly surprised to find out that they've needed to close their doors in some cases. And in other cases, some have been able to pivot in this circumstance and be able to adapt. And I just know, and I'm sure your listeners have similar experiences, when you just talk to some of these business owners, you know, some of them have really been creative about finding out how to survive in this particular climate and have adjusted. It's interesting when you talk to folks that have studied this in a great deal of depth. You know, sometimes you hear the term retail apocalypse being used as if everything is completely on a downward spiral. And some of the folks that have really studied this very carefully, who are much more well-versed in the economics of this than I am, really kind of put a caution on using that phrase, because there is some thought out there, and it seems to be bearing out with other data, that the decline is probably looked at more in terms of a right-sizing than an actual just complete plummet of brick-and-mortar stores.
Right.
So as e-commerce has been available, that's helped to, you know, how do you put this? I don't want to sound like this is some kind of survival of the fittest, but in some way it has put the pressure on so that those that maybe were less solid, and I want to be careful here. I do not want to say that somebody who has not been able to survive in this climate has somehow done something wrong. That's not the message. But it's just been that there has been a decrease in retail that may be just getting to a level where it probably should have been at, rather than the overexpansion that we've seen in this country over a long period of time. So that is one definite way to look at that. But the upshot is that this new change in how we do commerce is here to stay. The amount of just employment growth in different sectors, 50% increase in warehousing and storage. So this all has ramifications for where we go with this. And even in the amount of warehousing as a part of our economy, we have a greater percentage of that than Indianapolis in our economy. Not to mention, we are still in relative proximity to Indianapolis, where the second largest FedEx hub is. So we're really well positioned with our transportation network. The same network that gives rise to calling us the Crossroads of America is the very thing that helps goods and delivery like this excel, and we're right in the heart of it, and well poised to, I think, take advantage of what the future may hold.
We're talking with Ty Warner. He's the executive director of the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. NERPC has put out a new report entitled E-Commerce in Northwest Indiana. You can check it out on their website. And I know there's some recommendations. I'd like to touch on those here in a minute, Ty, but tell us a little bit about some of the areas here in Lake Porter and LaPorte counties that you all have noted that, as it says in the report, are uniquely positioned for growth. Tell us about those first.
Exactly. Well, we did a land use study, which is part of what we do. And I should just encapsulize for your listeners. NERPC is a council of governments. We are a unit of government, but we are not a layer of government. We are a body where all the 41 municipalities in Lake Porter and LaPorte counties come together on a regular basis to talk about things that are bigger than any one of them. And so part of that charge as a regional planning commission is to look at future trends and try to project growth to meet our other important designation, which is a Metropolitan Planning Organization for federal transportation funds. So this all works together in how you plan out the future of our connectivity and mobility in the region. Mm-hmm. So as part of that data, we looked at locations that are most conducive to e-commerce and where that can function at the most efficient level based on the particular needs of what goes into e-commerce. And we looked at five different clusters around the region and tried to analyze what is the best performing in terms of connectivity, being able to take advantage of these locations for e-commerce. So what the report tries to do in amongst its recommendations is to lay out, here is how this region can best position itself to try to take advantage of this future trend.
I know that there are some recommendations that the report is putting out, and you can check out in more detail, that gives some ideas, at least, on how some organizations and businesses and all can try to adapt and deal with the changeover, as we're seeing a big change in e-commerce from the usual traditional visit to the store. What are some of these recommendations that the full report talks about?
Sure. Well, I think one of the biggest ones that is most exciting to think about because of the opportunity involved is, as we've seen declines in shopping malls and other retail businesses, there are some great examples of the way communities have adaptively reused some aging mall facilities and big box retail and whatnot for other uses, whether that's to, as the report highlights, the occasion where a whole big box facility was transformed into a really stunning public library facility, to another shopping mall that integrated a whole hospital healthcare facility as part of the mall. And even just, I just saw just the other day, a little closer to home, Fox Valley Mall in Aurora, Illinois, and a proposal for a mixed-use development to take advantage of transforming part of the anchors in that store to be mixed-use development, which means, you know, not only commercial, but also residential and senior living facilities, and a way to integrate that into and coexist with existing retail. Mm-hmm. So there's some exciting examples we can pull from for adaptively reusing some of the facilities that are we're seeing a shift in their use. And then some of the other recommendations in the report that I think are really helpful for us to think about in the future for a host of reasons, but this is one of them, is the importance of the curb. And that sounds so basic to just talk about the curb, but especially when you're talking about your downtown areas or areas that are a bit more congested, as we move not only into more of an e-commerce environment, but as autonomous vehicles are on the horizon and that technology just keeps getting further and further along, the ability to transfer not only goods, but people right in front of businesses and locations becomes all the more important. So you may not have thought so much about the space in front of your store previously, but now in the midst of the pandemic, when so many restaurants are doing, you know, curbside service, and you're seeing locations that are marked, you know, keep this free for takeout only or curbside service only, right, so that the curb stays free. Already we're getting to that point where we're paying a lot more attention to what happens right on the street, right in front of the business. And that's only going to get more important as you have more and more deliveries happening and needs to be able to be efficient so that it doesn't block traffic, to be able to release their goods and move on to, as I mentioned, autonomous vehicles. When, again, I'm looking pretty far out, but that's what we try to do.
Well, you have to do that.
Absolutely. And that picture is one of, you know, for many thinking that maybe a shared option, much like, you know, ride hailing, things like Uber and Lyft and all that, where you, the autonomous vehicle comes, picks you up on demand, but you don't necessarily own it. But even if you do, the idea is that it comes picks you up where you are. And again, all the more important to manage that curb space for efficient delivery. And like I said, not just packages that you order off of online retail, but on down the road, potentially yourself as you travel here and there and want the vehicle to drop you off in front of a particular business.
Well, it sounds like, too, that it's something that in the report is going to be something that public officials here in Northwest Indiana should take a look at, because it may involve some serious changes in their tax revenue status.
It could. And while I don't want to put myself as being qualified to speak too much on that particular shifting landscape there, obviously there's some changes in use. And when you have changes in use, you have changes in revenue. And so I think it would behoove all of our communities to look carefully at what the future holds and try to adapt accordingly, which we say all the time on a bigger scale anyway. But particularly with this report, this brings it a little bit. Our plan goes out to the year 2050 that I mentioned, NWI 2050. Well, this is in the next, you know, few years we're talking about. So this is the here and now, and I think communities would do well to try to do what they can to pivot their communities to take advantage of that future. And NERPC is here to help with this. That's what we do.
Thank you for this great information. And here again, the full report, e-commerce in Northwest Indiana, is on the NERPC website, nerpc.org. And you can find out all the details if you'd like to dig into it deeper. Ty Werner is the executive director for NERPC. And thank you very much for being with us today and giving us this executive summary of the report. It's a great report to take a look at. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Appreciate being on.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Within the next decade, 9 coal-fired power plants in Indiana are expected to close or partially shut down. One of them is in Michigan City. And while that may mean cleaner air, it can also mean repercussions for the businesses as well as the towns that host the plant. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel tells us how the partial closure of a plant in rural southern Indiana will affect the people who live there and how they're working to be able to adapt.
In Petersburg, Indianapolis Power and Light is everywhere. You can see its logo on everything from the high school scoreboard to an Adopt-a-Highway sign. Almost everyone who lives in the town of less than 3,000 seems to be connected to the plant in one way or another. Tara Mullis is no exception. She owns the Caddyshack Restaurant, a small home-style diner made out of her grandparents' old storage barn. Locals come in and out to pick up styrofoam takeout boxes piling up behind the counter.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
Mullis says about half her customers work at the coal plant. IPL expects to lay off more than 100 workers when it closes down 2 of 4 coal units there in 2023.
And that makes up a lot of our community, and, you know, if they're not bringing in income, then they're not spending income either. So, yeah, it's worrisome.
But what really worries Mullis is what will happen if the plant ever shuts down completely. Her husband is a coal miner, and the plant purchases Indiana coal. It's not just plant workers and businesses that stand to suffer from the partial closure, however. Schools could also take a hit. IPL is Pike County's largest taxpayer, and a little less than half of those taxes go to the district. When the utility shifted some of its assets away from the Petersburg plant last year, the district lost $300,000. Pike County Schools Superintendent Suzanne Blake says the school corporation also gets about $6,000 per student.
If we don't reestablish either industry or business or a reason to draw families to this community, then they're going to locate elsewhere.
Attracting new businesses has been top of mind for Ashley Willis. She's the executive director for the Pike County Economic Development Corporation. Willis says the county has made some sites shovel-ready for industrial companies and helped fund a technology center. It also recently welcomed a new solar farm, which Willis expects will offset a third of the revenue that was lost last year.
Trying to get the next industries in here so that, you know, we're not playing catch-up and we don't fall behind. We want to transform and evolve as the trends do.
Blake says Pike County Schools is also doing what it can to attract industry by teaching the next generation of workers technical skills while they're still in high school. Kevin Carter teaches welding to juniors and seniors from 5 high schools in the area. The classes are popular. There are more than 30 students enrolled this year. Wearing protective helmets, they join pieces of metal together with torches inside individual booths. Then they come out to sand their work and get a critique.
Pattern's not perfect, but width looks good.
Carter says a lot of kids in Pike County grow up wanting to work at the coal plant. It's been seen as a high-paying, reliable job. He hopes his classes will open up multiple job opportunities for his students.
I mean, a skilled trade you can take and parlay into a lot of other jobs. I mean, you might be a welder at a coal mine or a power plant, but you could also maybe manufacture or do welding at a Toyota or some other manufacturing facilities.
That idea appeals to senior Hunter Russell, who wants to be a mechanical engineer.
Once I get to college, I've thought maybe traveling around a little bit, but I'm always probably going to be a homebody. I like it around here.
Though the Petersburg coal plant will have a partial shutdown in 3 years, IPL hasn't set a date to retire the plant completely. While the state works to figure out how Indiana should transition away from coal, locals hope they'll have enough time to make sure this small city doesn't turn into a ghost town. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
Coming up, a conversation about preserving a national architectural landmark in West Lafayette. There is a house designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. It's in West Lafayette in Tippecanoe County. The Samara House is very rare among the Frank Lloyd Wright designed works. And we have with us the curator of the Samara House with us to talk about it and also about the fact that they have picked up quite a distinction from Indiana Landmarks that will help along with the restoration of this house. Linda Eels is with us. Linda, thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio today.
Thank you for having me.
For folks that have never, ever heard about the Samara House, tell us about the house. Tell us how the house came about, and then now particularly the historic significance of it.
Okay, so the Christians married in 1948, and one of the things they talked about was that they wanted to entertain faculty and staff and students in their home. They wanted to have what was known as salons back in the 50s, so they knew they needed an architect. And they started looking around and looked up in Chicago and didn't really find anybody up there. But then Dr. Christian went to a conference in New York City, and Mrs. Christian, of course, tagged along, right? And she heard about a small community in Pleasantville, New York, called Usonia. And this is a Usonian-type home, okay? And she visited there. She found out that Wright had designed the community, and then she found out that he had designed three of the homes as well. And she visited one of the homes, and she loved it. And Dr. Christian visited as well, and he loved it too. So they just decided then and there, we'll just get this Frank Lloyd Wright guy, whoever that is, right, to be our architect. No big deal.
It's amazing that, like, here again, that somebody had really not ever heard of Frank Lloyd Wright, but his style of construction, of architecture, I should say, and construction, both because he was very much involved in the construction in a way of all of his works, from the prairie homes that he came up with, some of which are still in existence, one in particular around Chicago and other places as well, and some out in the countryside and in other states besides here in the Midwest. But it's all coming down to a particular style, a particular, I guess, aspect of Frank Lloyd Wright's makeup as an architect that have made these homes like the Samara House come about. How did the relationship that Frank Lloyd Wright had with the Christians come about, and how did it hold up after all these years, basically, when the house was finally built and they got a chance to live in it?
Right. Well, the Christians didn't know what to do. They did research and found out about Wright, and they didn't know what to do, how to get in touch with him. So one day, out of just sheer frustration, Dr. Christian just picked up the phone and called Taliesin in Spring Green, Wisconsin, and guess who answered the phone? Frank Lloyd Wright. So they had a lovely conversation. That conversation ended with an invitation to come up and visit Mr. Wright, which they did a couple of weeks later, at which point they found out how lucky they were that Wright had answered the phone. Because if any of the other people that were supposed to answer the phone, they would have told them they were crazy. There was no way Wright had time to design a small home for them. Where? West Lafayette, Indiana. Who ever heard of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that first meeting, not much happened. It was just a get-to-know-you meeting. But then Wright sent them off with an assignment. He said, come back and tell me what you need in your home, not what you want. And so Mrs. Christian was a very detailed woman, and she prepared a 26-page typewritten document entitled What We Need for How We Live. It had a table of contents. It had a biography of Dr. Christian and a photograph, a biography of Mrs. Christian and a photograph of their daughter, Linda, who at 14 months didn't have much of a biography yet, just said baby. She had a listing of all the various rooms in the house, what sort of activities were going to take place in those rooms, what sort of storage she needed, and just all kinds of incredible stuff. And so she presents him with this booklet, and as you could imagine, he was absolutely blown away, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, Dr. Christian just belted out, Mr. Wright, will you design a home for me? And Wright kind of looked away and cleared his throat like he was going to say no, but he didn't. He said, of course I'll design your home for you. But then he turned to Mrs. Christian and he said, but Mrs. Christian, how much money have you got?
Well,
you can imagine, they were newlyweds, right? They didn't have any money. And so when she responded, recovered, she said, Mr. Wright, we don't have any money. You know, we're saving our money to build the house. And he liked that. He thought that was a good thing, definitely.
It shows how important honesty really is. You know, they were honest, and he couldn't but not accept it.
Exactly. 100%. And I think he had more respect for them, too, because of that.
When it got to the point where it was going to come down to basically the design, and we know that Frank Lloyd Wright is famous for basically designing his structures and wanting complete assistance from the people who have asked have him be commissioned for him to do the work. And he is certainly known for the fact that his other houses that are still standing and have become national landmarks. These type of facilities are ones that have everything. I mean, absolutely everything. It's details right down to the style of furniture. And I guess in this case, too, even to the faucets in the bathroom.
Oh, yes, and also the landscape design. He did it all, the complete environment there. He controlled it all. And the most amazing thing is that the Christians did what he told them to do. Well, not all clients did by any stretch of the imagination. So this is one of the most complete right designs that you will see. And we need to be proud of that, yeah.
How did the land around the house and, of course, eventually the house itself get to be named the Samara House?
Wolf Wright named it. It is... He knew the Christians liked pine trees, and they had them all over the house. Dr. Christian was landscaping the house with the pine trees. And so he knew that inside the pine cone are little seeds that are, the botanical name for them is Samara, okay? And he knew that that was inside those pine cones, and he knew that they did the same thing as their bigger cousins, the ones that, like the maple seed, that helicopter, right? And so he then named the house Samara after those winged seeds that helicopter around. And he did the motif. He made up a motif from that design and put it all over the house.
Now, I know that the Christians working with Frank Lloyd Wright on this home, on this design, and get the home constructed, took from, I guess, 1951 until 1956 before it was finally built. How long did the Christians get to live in the house, and what has been the disposition of the house over the years after they left?
Okay, so Dr. Christian lived in the house until 2015 when he died on his 98th birthday. And Mrs. Christian lived there until 1986. So she lived there almost 30 years, and he lived there almost 60 years. The house was then given to Dr. Christian's daughter, Linda Christian Davis, who has since, in 2018, turned the house over to the trust that Dr. Christian and his daughter set up in 1993. And so the trust is held by Indiana Landmarks, and we co-steward the house with Indiana Landmarks. We're very, very lucky to have that wonderful relationship with them.
Now, since we have had this relationship with Indiana Landmarks, it just stands to reason that if the funds become available, public funds at least, that it should certainly go toward working on this house. The public grant that you've just received has come out, the announcement of $1 million that Indiana Landmarks is helping to set aside to fund the restoration of this particular house. And I understand there's matching money, too, from the trust.
Yes. Yes. But we're going to do fundraising as well. Don't think we're going to spend all the trust money, but we'll be doing some fundraising too, mm-hmm. to help meet that goal.
Now, what will the funds, both public and what you've raised and whatever that comes out of the trust that you set aside for this work, what is it going to go toward? How much restoration work has to be done on the Samara House right now?
Right. We have a problem with the terrace, which is on the southeast part of the house. There is a downspout there that has, over the years, washed away the gravel and sand that was underneath the concrete there, and it's caused the terrace to drop down. So that needs to be repaired, definitely. And then also the wall on the lanai, which is on the north side of the house, has become detached from the house. So that has to be repaired as well. That wall will probably have to be completely rebuilt. And then there's just things like, you know, we need to restain the wood. We need to repair the wood. Mm-hmm. We need to, you know, just fix things that are, you know, concrete is cracked and things like that.
So it's things that you would expect, number one, for a 64-year-old house that have to be done. But number two, it's a house that is so famous because Frank Lloyd Wright designed it and had supervised its construction. It has to be perfectly the way it was when Frank Lloyd Wright stepped out of the house for the final time and turned it over to the Christians.
Exactly. And we're a National Historic Landmark, so we have to abide by the Secretary of the Interior's rules. So we can't go and do something in a way that would be proper.
What kind of timetable do you have now that you know that Indiana Landmarks has the public funds that are going to be available, and you're still going to do the fundraising effort to help for as far as the local match of the money, to be sure? When do you hope to have some of the restoration work started?
Well, I'm hoping almost immediately, but I'm, you know, that's me because I've been dealing with this for quite a while. But I'm hoping we're going to have a meeting, a board meeting on Friday, and we are going to figure out next steps at that point, and hopefully we'll be hit the floor running.
So you're hoping sometime, at least early in October, with the show, you'll be able to get something as far as what's planned as far as the restoration work is concerned.
Yeah, I think that's a little ambitious, but, you know, you can always hope, right?
What kind of reaction have you gotten from folks there in West Lafayette, the people who are most concerned about the Samara House and others who have been watching very closely, and folks from Indiana Landmarks, for that matter, about how this house is going to be worked on? What do they have to say about this great gift that Indiana Landmarks is helping in funding the restoration, or at least their share of it?
Yeah, we're all just super excited and just beyond thrilled that we have this opportunity and are just going to work very hard to use every penny the right way and the proper way and the best way, and really looking forward to getting this undergoing. Yeah.
Now, I know that you're working on a website. It's in progress right now. Are there pictures that people can take a look at on the internet of what the Samara House looks like, since you can't go in right now because of the pandemic and other things?
Right. We have been doing, with other public rights sites, we have been doing what we're calling right virtual visits. And that's a hashtag, right virtual visits. Mm-hmm. And if you go on any social media site and enter that in, or you can go to the Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy website and see those. We have tons of videos that all the public sites have done where you can see videos of all these buildings. And it's really fabulous. Highly recommend that.
That's Linda Eales. She is the curator of the Samara House. It's a house that is built in West Lafayette, not terribly far from the Purdue University campus, a house that was started as a design in the minds of a Purdue University professor and his wife, and it finally was turned into an actual house thanks to Frank Lloyd Wright. And thank you very much, Linda, for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. We are off for Thanksgiving Day tomorrow, but we'll be back on Monday when we talk with Indiana Gaming Insight editor Ed Fagenbaum, and we hope you can join us.